Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for September's Exotics Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome back to the webinar club our speaker for today, lecturer and clinical manager of the Exotic Animal and Wildlife Clinic at the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies, University of Edinburgh, Kevin Eatwell. Thank you, Kevin. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, Aima. Today's session, we're going to be looking at dealing with pet fish coming into the clinic in part for today. And I think fish are these sort of things that some people see a lot of, some people see intermittently. They're quite different and exciting, really, to have as patients coming through. And I suppose we're going to see a couple of scenarios here. If we've got a single fish coming in versus to having a group problem in the fish, then obviously our approach can vary, and we're going to cover both of these during today's session. A group, you may have a large pond that you're dealing with or facility that you're dealing with. Single fish, generally they walk into, well, they don't walk into your clinic, but they are presented in your clinic in a bucket, and here's my fish, there's something that I've noticed wrong with it. If we're going to transport fish into the clinic, which I suppose is the first thing, then we do have to be aware that they do produce waste during transit. That water temperature may vary as well. And certainly if you've got them in a bucket with a lid on or something like that, again, you're going to have a sealed unit. Your pH may be altering as well. You may have ammonia being produced as well. You've got a risk of the water quality deteriorating. So in these sort of circumstances, if a fish is being presented to you in a bucket, at least really you want to be venting the air from the surface to allow that CO2 to escape and reoxygenating the water for that individual before it goes home in its bucket again after it's seen you. If you're anticipating and you have the opportunity to intervene before the fish arrives, having a bucket of spare water to transport the fish home is sensible. But if you're looking at doing anaesthesia and things, then an extra bucket might be sensible as well. So bear in mind, depending on the presentation, you might want the fish in a bucket and maybe up to two more buckets of water from that fish's environment. And of course, if I've got a group of fish, then the mortality or clinical signs in that entire group is of interest to me. Have there been any recent introductions? How has management changed? This sort of thing will be going on my clinical history questioning. If it's one fish sitting at home isolated in a tank, then obviously we're not going to have massive management changes or change in fish coming in. And our history can then focus a bit more on what that one fish has been doing. Water quality is something we should be assessing in all fish presenting coming through. It's basic husbandry, really, in the end of the day. Owners may have quite variable knowledge of water quality. They won't be monitoring that. They won't know how to maintain that. And some fish might very well have sort of quite variation in water quality depending on the husbandry, have peaks and troughs in quality, which can of course upset them. I think when we're looking at fish metabolic rate, I think this is also something else that's wise to get your head around first, is they are genuine poikilothermics. They are dependent on the water temperature for their metabolic rate. And much as they can move around in the water, basically that's about all they can do for thermoregulation. So fish have a standard metabolic rate. It's directly linked to water temperature. And obviously, if they're overwintering outside, they're going to go into deeper water to stop themselves from freezing. So basically, the metabolic rate is completely temperature dependent. They tend to be measured in degree days for withdrawal period, and every 10 degree elevation in temperature will double the metabolic rate. Same applies to the pathogens, of course. So most of your pond fish from outside, they will present in the summer months, because in the winter they're all sitting at the bottom of the pond. They're doing nothing. Their pathogens are doing nothing. If it's a household pet fish, at a higher water temperature, then obviously that can present all year round. And the other thing worth rule of thumb worth mentioning here is if a fish is metabolically active, then it consumes 1% of its body weight in food per day would be a fairly standard food rate and uptake. So water quality, like I say, is the first step for these. Feeding is relevant because, of course, if they feed, they're excreting nitrogen waste. This nitrogen waste then has to be removed by the system. So monitoring the water quality is something that you should be doing in the clinic and our owners should be doing at home. This is a very brief summary of the nitrogen cycle for you. Basically, dead plants, soil runoff, waste food, ammonia producing from the fish by about 3 days of being introduced into the tank, all of this material is removed or managed by Nitrosomus bacteria. So this comes back to whether it's inside or outside. If you've got a lot of soil coming in, you've got necrotic plants in there or waste food entering into your system. And again, this does apply to the aquatic chelonians and things as well. You can increase the workload for the Nitrosomus to remove this. They convert the ammonia to nitrite in the end of the first week. And then Nitrobacter, over a more protracted time, will convert this into nitrate. And it sort of takes 4 to 6 weeks for a system to mature. And by this, what we mean is when you put a fish in water, there's no bacteria in that water doing this work. These have to grow and develop to enable them to have the capacity to deal with the waste from the fish. And this is why when people are having a tank at home and they're setting it up, they will progressively, gradually introduce fish as the bacterial flora mature to cope with the waste. So this bacterial load in the water is vital. It's the critical part of this. The filtration system you've got, which normally a box, sort of canister filters on the outside, these are designed to filter out large debris, but also provide a very large surface area so all the denitrifying bacteria can grow and continue their job of filtering out the nitrogenous waste. Your filter is alive and a critical component of this setup. Now, one thing just to put on the side here, let's suggest I was due to import a large batch of fish or move a large batch of fish and I needed to have a pond ready functional for them, then what I would do is set the pond up, put the filter in place, and then I would start incrementally adding ammonia to the water in sequentially increasing volumes to allow the bacterial filters to mature from, if you like, an artificial ammonia source. And over sort of 4 or 6 weeks, when I was happy that the tank was mature, I'd then stop putting in ammonia liquid and I pop in my fish in one go. And that's how sort of a lot of the importers and pet shops will manage their fish collections. They'll be maturing a tank ready for fish to come into weeks in advance to get the filter up and running. The sort of common mistakes that you get, I spend a lot of time in the fish consultation with certainly with pet owners of individual fish, going through what they do with their filter. People assume the filter is filtering the water, so if the filter's dirty, it can't do that, so then they clean it and they put it under hot top water and clean it until it sparkles. And that's quite a common owner mistake. And what they do, of course, is they kill off all of the bacteria, and then basically you've got a new tank again, and so you get a subsequent spike in these levels and you're starting from scratch again. What you should be doing here is just removing the physical debris. And picture the scenario, if you've got a lot of physical debris blocking access to your filters, the water will flow around the sides of the filters and back into the tank again. So you want to remove your debris so it goes through the filter, but not so much as to damage it. And if you've got physical debris and you want to rinse it off, then quite simply get some tank water and use that to flush out the debris. You don't want to be using tap water, if that makes sense, and we'll come on to why tap water is potentially a bad thing in due course. Water changes are often used, and as your nitrates build up over time, much as they are less toxic, they've got to be removed. If you're in a pond situation, lake situation, then the plants in that environment would absorb the nitrates to complete the cycle and then liberate CO2, obviously, as they do with photosynthesis. Absorb CO2. I'll get that right in a minute. But if obviously if we're using water changes to eliminate out your nitrates, what we have to be aware of is your tap water contains the chlorine and chloramine, chloramine being more difficult to get rid of. And this obviously is designed to kill off bacteria in our water sources that we're drinking. But obviously this can kill off your filter and be irritant to the surface and the gills of the fish as well. A lot of people like to make things easy, so they think, oh, I'll do a water change. And what they might do then is start doing this once a week, once a fortnight. And what they do then is do a large water change. So again, you get instability and peaks and troughs in your water quality. What you should be doing is doing little water changes on a regular basis. So the system is closed. You've got to give it time to mature to respond to nitrogenous waste. If you don't have plants, which a lot of cases don't, then we've got a live filter, which we need to look after. Small volume water changes incrementally will clear out the nitrogenous waste without causing the peaks and troughs. And if you're getting algal growth in your water, it's going green, then obviously there is excess nitrogen waste supporting algal growth. Maybe it's food, maybe it's soil runoff, maybe it's leaves, this sort of type thing, which we can see. Or that's a sign then obviously water quality is poor. You shouldn't have algal growth in your tank. So if you've got chlorine in your water and you want to liberate it from the water, if you put tap water into a bucket, relatively large surface area, then the chlorine will dissipate overnight and that water then is suitable to use for your fish the following day. If you want to speed up that process, then sodium thiosulfate can be added, and they're sold as sort of lots of water conditioners, things like this. These basically convert the chlorine to free gas and its removal quickly so that tap water can be instantly used. If you want to try and get rid of dechlorination, then basically we're really looking here at having vitamin C in addition to some of these as well for the ascorbic acid to remove the chloramines as well. But they are more difficult to get rid of than your chlorines. So given all of the problems that we can have with our water quality, then testing this is of paramount importance. We want a clean sample of water in a clean container to examine. Sample that's been submitted here with this fish, I have a dead fish in a bowl of water that's decomposing, that's going to have poor water quality. I know it is. It's not a reflection of the tank water it was in. I need the tank water it was in uncontaminated to see. So we want a fresh sample of water, clean glass or plastic container for me to test. Test kits are easy to get hold of, mostly based on colour. The standard sort of that we would use would be pH, nitrate, ammonia, nitrite. I mean, it's fairly standard, fairly easy for your basic test kit. Ammonia is a toxic. Ammonium is not. So as your pH is lowered, you get less ammonia toxicity. As your temperature rises, you get a shift as well, so toxicity increases in warmer weather. Nitrates are toxic. Salt is a common sort of treatment that's added, and we use rock salt here. This actually can reduce toxicity in the face of poor water quality by reducing methemoglobin formation with that, so that can help. And obviously nitrates are taken up by plants or removed. But normally with a lot of these cases, it's ammonia levels we're interested in, where people are making errors with their setup. So Basically, ideally, we want zero. That's the honest answer. But really, your upper levels for your normal fish, we've got on, I say normal fish, is 0.1 for ammonia, 0.1 nitrate, 10 for your nitrates, and a pH between 6 and 8 would be fairly standard. And this is just a pH here, a pH test being done here. So having gone through and looked at your water quality, I suppose the next thing then is looking at what's wrong with my fish. And I think the range of presentations in fish in practice is quite limited, really. They've got altered buoyancy, they've got an altered shape, maybe their behaviour is different, and there might be a mass or a colour change that has provoked the owner into thinking something isn't quite right with their fish. Altered buoyancy, obviously, is fairly obvious, and most people will come with this, complain that it's got swim bladder disease. That's a bit of an old school thing, to, you know. But what we are looking at, if your buoyancy has been altered, is that the swim bladder position or shape or size has become distended or altered, or alternatively, the I guess buoyancy of the remainder of the tissue of the fish has altered. Maybe there's granulomas, maybe there's fluid, maybe there's a mass, maybe there's some gas. Second thing you're going to have is an altered shape of fish. So this fish here, quite marked distension of the coelomic cavity. We've got eyes popping out of its head as well. Okay, so this would be called dropsy or pine cone disease. But again, the question is, why have you got this body change? Is this a mass? Is this granulomas? Is this fluid? And then you're into altered behaviour, and I've just shown a fish here now with fish lice, where this animal will be pruritic, what we call sort of flashing against the sides of the tank, rubbing itself, this sort of type thing, just as an example. But again, people will present that. For example, if you've got poor oxygenation, the fish might be hugging around the pumps because that's a bit that is oxygenated, for example. And obviously then you've got mass or colour change, you've got something on the skin. This is just an ulcer here on a koi carp, but again something that is provoking you don't look the same way that you used to. I'm going to come and get you to the vet and have you looked at. When you're assessing fish, you want to wear powder-free gloves because you don't want to contaminate the water with anything, and obviously don't want to contaminate them with your skin or yours either. And you can use soap towels and things to reduce the risk of damage from them while you're assessing the fish. Lower the lights down, they do not like bright lights. Now you may be in a situation that you think you want to keep hold of the fish. If it's a really small fish that's come in, sometimes they just bring in the entire tank and say, here's my fish, there's something not right. Great, I'll hang on to your tank. I can then look after your fish longer term. It's difficult to keep a consistent temperature and water quality for hospitalised fish. You tend to find that most people just don't have that sort of setup available. And again, if we're having a fish presented in a tub, this is again another koi, that's been caught presenting it now in a plastic tub, we've got to be desperately concerned about the water quality that this fish has been exposed to and look at sorting that problem out quite quickly. And this is where if they could brought it in with no spare water, you may be reaching for your sodium thiosulfate to get some water that you can do an exchange on to try and keep this fish viable. So if we start thinking now how we're going to investigate fish that are coming in, and I'm just going to sort of cover skin diseases here a little bit for you because this is visual and something you might want to do in consult potentially, because you might want to be starting to look at getting skin or gill samples, which you can send for a culture, you can do some cytology. Again, we do have to be aware that we're going to get a lot of secondary opportunistic bacterial, fungal elements, all sorts of pathogens coming in here, and you've got to try and work out which is the primary underlying cause here. So ulceration, for example, if you're seeing ulcers being presented in koi or goldfish, for example, Eremonas is typically implicated as underlying cause of what we call furunculosis, but a lot of these are bacterial. So again, taking a culture swab from this may be relevant at that time. The downside of taking your cultures is you might not get the main pathogens here, But you tend to make the leap of faith that whatever sensitivity comes out on your culture swab, you assume the other agents are going to have a similar effect, and so you're going to go with that. But just be mindful of choosing your right antibiotics as well. Cytology is brilliant here. If you're thinking you've got gill changes, and obviously taking a swab directly from the gill can be helpful because you're hopefully going to have less surface contamination. Or you can take little gill snips and biopsies for that to look either at cytology or histopath, looking for pathogens. And I think we're sort of moving progressively now in the direction of, if I'm going to do more to your fish, I'm kind of going to have to be anaesthetizing you. So fish anaesthesia, again, it is completely different to anaesthetizing patients that live on land. And so we've got to go a little bit through their anatomy and physiology before we start, really. So fish, they use their gills to exchange their gases. These gill filaments are very vascular, large surface area for exchanging oxygen and carbon dioxide in the water. And what they basically do is they pull oxygenated water through their mouths, pump it over the gills laterally, they absorb the oxygen, excrete the carbon dioxide, and that's how it works, basically. They're very complex in terms of there's cartilaginous or bony gill arches in here, lots of gill slits or an operculum to the outside. There's a sort of a countercurrent exchange system between these, so they're very efficient at what they do in the water. And basically, water comes into the mouth and is forced out the gill openings to the outside, and that's how they breathe in the water. So given they are completely dependent on dissolved oxygen, then we've got to ensure that we do oxygenate that water adequately. And again, if they've got low oxygen levels, they might sit at the top because dissolved oxygen is higher. They might sit next to your filter where the water is becoming more turbulent or being put back in because that increases the ability of the oxygen to dissolve in that water environment. So an air stone is very, very useful to do that, to make sure you can maintain your levels of oxygen in the water for them. And these are just fairly simple. And you can attach these onto your bog standard circuit, and you can put a low flow rate of 100% oxygen through your air stone, drop that in the bottom of your water, and you're able to reoxygenate the water. So if we go back to looking at this sort of setup here, I could get some sodium thiosulfate, do a quick water change on head to reduce the amount of contamination here, popping an air stone and reoxygenate that. And if your fish, for example, has come in a plastic bag, then that's great. You can vent off the air, compress it down, and then just basically put oxygen into the bag, tie a knot on the top of the bag. Then that fish basically has 100% oxygen above the water, which of course will also increase the amount of dissolved oxygen that it has. So going through and testing your water is quite important. And if you're going to make up water for them from your water source, again, you need to dechlorinate it before you start. Check its pH. You might need to modify that. Check the temperature. We want the temperature that you're going to be anaesthetizing this fish in to be the same temperature to which it's normally exposed. Starvation for fish, we would normally do that for sort of 12, 24 hours prior to anaesthesia. Otherwise, they might reflux stomach contents and contaminate their gill arches and gill rakers with that, which would be quite unpleasant, and that could lead to respiratory compromise. So again, we would like to ensure they don't, their risk of regurgitation is minimized. And realistically, you might anaesthetize fish for three reasons in the practical setting. It may be we want to be euthanasing this fish, and anaesthetizing it means it becomes immobilized, is rendered insensible to pain, and then obviously we can then go ahead and euthanize it with some pentobarbital or something if we wanted to. It may be there's an individual fish in which you're trying to either perform surgery or run diagnostics on, and you need to anaesthetize it for humane reasons. And it may be if you're on site that you need to anaesthetize multiple fish to move them between environments or to administer treatments to them, depending on what you're doing. So you may be ranging your anaesthesia maybe from just a very light sedation for transport through to maybe slightly deeper for diagnostic sampling, through to a full surgical plane for removing a mass, for example. Again, range of anaesthetic levels in the fish. Don't really need to know these to some extent, but obviously it's useful to you can evaluate how you're doing. And realistically, for a lot of these cases, we're looking at the light anaesthesia level for a lot of these, where we're getting a loss of their righting reflex, and you're able to manipulate the fish in the water with minimal response. When they get the total loss of equilibrium, respiration settles right down. You're down to basically minimal respiration. That's a deeply anaesthetized fish that's suitable for surgery, if that makes sense. So immersion anaesthesia is inhalation anaesthesia for fish. And what we're doing here is we're adding water-soluble agents to a known volume of water, so we get a set concentration in that water for the fish. And because this is just a ratio, the weight of the fish is irrelevant. And as they breathe underwater, they will be absorbing it over the gills. This will act on the CNS. Your fish will become anaesthetized. So the advantages of this, to some extent, is you do get a fairly immediate response, which is great. It's relatively safe to do. Recovery is rapid following putting them back into fresh water. You don't need to physically restrain them. Your downsides, of course, here, though, of course, is you do need to, can present difficulties in how do I alter the depth of anaesthesia. For longer procedures, it's not really suitable, and some anaesthetics can be irritant. But I think practically for fish in practice, immersion anaesthesia works fine. Of course, we do know they're stressful. You might not have many facilities to keep hold of the fish for more than a couple of hours, so bring in at least a couple of spare volumes of water. And what you've got here, you've got the fish in one at least, and an empty one. Plan the time at which they arrive. So if you're going to want to perform procedures, we don't want the fish sitting around waiting all day. The fish comes in, you planned it right, you get on and do your procedure, you induce it in maybe the water it's in, or if it's been a long distance of travel, maybe in the clean bucket, but then you want another clean bucket to recover after you have finished your procedure. And your temperature that the fish is exposed to needs to be altered slowly. So running tap water, for example, tap water is going to be considerably colder than water that's been allowed to accustom to room temperature. And if this fish has been housed at room temperature, then you've got to let your water warm up. And a gradual temperature change where your fish gets the chance to accommodate to it is important. So if you've had to go through and create a separate set of water for it, then what you can do is you can just pop your fish in its bag in the new water. The fish gets the idea then of what's going on. The water temperature changes slowly, and then you can obviously liberate your fish into your tank. Again, oxygenate your water. Attach it to your anaesthetic machine and just bubble oxygen through here. The air soon increases surface area, so it's better than just putting it in from the end of a circuit. But again, you're getting a oxygenation ready for this fish before you anaesthetize it. And what you want to do realistically is going from awake to the plane that you want the fish to be at as quickly as you can do. Now, okay, if you're unfamiliar with fish anaesthesia, it's different species, you don't know how they're going to react to the agents, then incrementally dosing is maybe the way forward. And obviously, you can test it out on a small individual before you start doing it on the really expensive koi. So when you're starting out, maybe slowly is the way forward. When you get them being induced progressively, you will have hyperactivity. And it could be they're excited, could be irritant nature of the agents. And if you're concerned that your pH is being altered by the agents, then you can buffer the water as well. And certainly if you're using things like bicarbonate to do that, then that's fine. We don't want them to jump out, and they don't like bright light. So this fish cannot jump out and flap around on the floor, damaging its appearance. That will be stopped. And this fish is in the dark. Great. We just have to have a little peek every now and again to see how the fish is doing. So think about how you want a quiet and dark induction for anybody else. We want the same for our fish. And the opercular movements on these is the respiratory rate. Okay, response to stimulation can also provide a rough guide. So once the fish is started to be sedated, we will then manipulate the fish, start moving it around in the water, turning it upside down, assessing a righting response, things like that, to determine when it's achieved the plane that we want. For a more protracted anaesthesia, on a fish anaesthetic delivery system, what's called a FADS, where we're going to have to recycle and use this water to deliver it over the gills on a regular basis. And again, that's probably more advanced than you're going to need for the vast majority of cases that you would be seeing in clinical practice. So again, if you don't get water from the owner, you're going to have to do it yourself. Dechlorinate it, vent it to the air, use some sodium thiosulfide or carbon filters or ascorbic acid to get the chloramines out of the way. You've got to make sure this water is ready. MS-222, or trichane methane sulfonate, is a licensed, and I guess it used to be the main agent that we used. It's a light powder, you have to keep it away from moisture, and then you have to weigh it out, and I guess you have to pretend to be a drug lord or something while you're trying to work out splitting your white powder to get the weight that you want. And because it's quite fine and accurate, you really need scales that are going to go down to 0.1 of a gram here to get the accuracy that you need, which thankfully we have in our pharmacy in the hospital here. But in practice, if you're getting down to 1 gram, your accuracy is quite limited with the MS-222. It's also quite acidic, so you're going to have to buffer it to even that out. You can get irritation of the fish, and in fact having it at a low pH actually reduces efficacy as well because of the shift in ionization too. So we actually use bicarbonate of soda for these to level them out, or sodium bicarb, and basically if you mix sort of a 2-to-1, you'll kind of get the value that you want to maintain your pH roughly where you want it. Use your urinary dipsticks or use your pH test kit that you've got anyway for testing the pond. That works perfectly fine. You want to get an even concentration throughout the entire water for these. So make up a stock solution if you like, of 10 grams per litre. That makes it maybe fits in with your scales. And then obviously what you want to do then is, if you're mixing a higher concentration, a small volume of water, you want to mix this with the water in the tank to reach the final concentration. You don't want any hot spots where it's more concentrated in one area. So if we make up a stock solution, what we then tend to do is have it in a jug, and we're mixing that thoroughly with the water. Or if the fish is in, if you like, in water, fresh water, and you're going to add the anaesthetic to the water the fish is in, then we'll mix up a stock solution in the jug using some of the water from in which the fish has been supplied, bearing in mind the entire total of volume of water is a value we know, so we know how much agent we need in total for that entire bath. We then take some of that water out, mix the anaesthetic in with that, and we drift and spread that around the entire surface. We don't just chuck it in one corner, it's spread across the entire surface. Concentrations are variable on the MS-222 depending on what you want. And obviously, like I say, you know, it's do I have scales accurate enough to help me here? And if you're euthanasing, maybe we're not so bothered. Maybe we are just going to put some powder into the water with some bicarb and wait until the fish falls over. Maybe that's okay. But again, not ideal if you want the fish to remain viable, because you've got to extract it at the right time point before it crashes. And I would be encouraging you not to do that. But again, you've got to work out how much to add. Getting the right level of MSC, MS-222 can be problematic as well. The other thing you'll be aware of is get your cat into water courses. You do not put this water down the sink. This water has to go over soil to be disposed of. And you need a health and safety protocol to use because it's potentially carcinogenic as well. So realistically, MS-222 in this day and age is gone in the, we don't use it anymore. Benzocaine, again, it's used this quite historically, very similar to MS-222, not really needed at that stage anymore now, really. We've gone away from that. We're really down to two things now. Clove oil, which the main ingredient is eugenol, is great. You can just go and buy it in Boots. Practically, one drop per litre works pretty well. Fish owners, the more experienced koi keepers, for example, they'll be doing this themselves routinely. We tend to try and mix it in warm water initially. Again, avoid hot spots, works quite nice. And you've got Aquaceda now as well, which is marketed. This is 2-phenoxyethanol, works very well, and it's a pump delivery. So one pump is 0.5 mil, and that works brilliantly. In terms of you add that to a litre, that's the amount that you need, and obviously you can titrate it progressively from then on. So it's quite a nice one to use. So we're just going to go through looking at some images now of fish undergoing anaesthesia. So again, we've got our waters containers clearly labelled so we know what's going on here, and we're basically watching these guys become anaesthetised. We're looking for a loss in that writing reflex, which we have here. And obviously, when you get to a complete loss of writing reflex, you can start manipulating the fish a bit more. And in this circumstance, we're actually monitoring the heart rate with a Doppler here to confirm our fish is doing okay. Fish are scared of light. Cover the eyes. Damped. So this damp towel is being used. It's got tank water that's been used for it, but it's keeping the skin moist, it's stopping damage, we're covering the eyes. They've obviously got a spectacle over the eye, so you're not going to damage their cornea by sticking a towel over it, but this will obviously keep the fish a little bit more sedate and happy, and there won't be any bright lights coming in. For monitoring, you can use movement of the operculum, so we're going to watch for breathing here. We can monitor the heart rate with a Doppler, and obviously movement and response to stimulation can all be recorded as well to confirm your fish is currently happy. And once you've got them anaesthetised, if you wish to keep them anaesthetised for a little bit longer, then you can use anaesthetic-laden water or fresh water, depending on what you want to do, and this can be place into the mouth, and you can just direct your, you can just jet this syringe left or right to go over your gill arches as you're going through and doing that. And this will sort of keep them asleep a little bit longer for you. Snips, scrapes, cultures can then be taken from your gills. These will bleed a little bit, but just you're just taking a little edge from it. The one tip I would say if you're going to take gill samples is don't take gill samples from the first gill arch. Take it from the second. Sometimes with the first gill arch you can get a rinsing effect from the water as it flows through, which is less pronounced on the second arch back, which then you might find you get an increased parasite concentration on that second arch versus the first arch. And if you've got areas of ulceration or damaged scales that are beyond repair, then maybe you're going to start debriding these, and obviously then you can look at these samples as well for your cytology. And we're just looking here, we've got Trichodinella here and a gill fluke here, the sort of parasites you're going to be hunting for and finding. And there's lots of reference texts out there that you can just basically have sitting on your side to say, okay, I found something that's moving, let's go and find out what that is and what is the most appropriate treatment for that. And having taken your gill snips and samples that you want to in this circumstance for recovery, get them into fresh water with no anaesthetic in there. They have a buccal flow heart rate reflex. So if you want to increase their heart rate, swimming them in the right direction through the water will elevate heart rate and improves their clearance of agents as well. And of course, when they're under GA, you can apply water directly to the gills as well to help them recover if you wish to, if you think they've gone too deep. But we do spend a lot of our time getting the students to slowly swim a fish around in fresh water, slowly to encourage water flow over the gills to enable them to eliminate the agent. And I put this picture in here more for my own amusement than anything else. If you really think your fish is under medullary collapse, high pressure water running over the gills will help. And ironically, sticking under the tap is not a bad idea if you're really desperate for getting them to recover from their GA. If we're moving on to doing diagnostics now in an individual fish here, then imaging's okay. You can do that when they're awake, providing the time out of the water is short. So we will take radiographs, lateral radiographs certainly with a conscious fish. But again, if you're concerned they're going to start flapping about, then maybe sedation is going to be needed. Ultrasound, you can scan them in the water. Water is great. It's a beautiful send-off for your probes. So again, you can do some ultrasound directly in the water if you wish to. Okay, this is an anaesthetized fish now having some radiographs taken, but again can be quite useful. Your interpretation may be a little bit limited on some of these based on your experience, but I'll just sort of put one picture up here for you. And this is a fish that was having abnormal buoyancy in the water. Again, it's got swim bladder disease is your first thing. But just to make the point here, this animal actually has an enteritis, so we have altered gas within the GI tract. And because it's got a gas-filled loop within its GI tract, that is making the caudal end of the fish more buoyant. And this is why the fish was looking down at the bottom end of the tank. So a lot of the swim bladder disease is not swim bladder, it's buoyancy issues. Look for a granuloma, look for coelomic ascites, look for gas in the GI tract. And so your radiography, of course, will help you achieve that. If you're progressing on to thinking that you're looking at doing surgery on these fish, and in a lot of cases you will be asked to do that, then clearly we're moving on a little step now in terms of how am I going to achieve that. So you can do a bit of sedation and a bit more again and in and out of the water as you need to. This is a fish now having some ultrasound, having a DV radiograph taken as well. And we're kind of in the water, out of the water, in the water, out of the water. That's okay. That's like face masking a chinchilla for a dental, I guess. It sort of works. But if you want to do longer procedures, we're doing celioscopy here on this particular example, then we've got to think of a way of making this work for a longer time period. So a fish anaesthetic delivery system is designed to give anaesthetic laden water over the gills continuously during your procedure. And what you want to do is to be able to capture that water so you can recirculate it back over the gills again. And you want to have some fresh water so you can alter the plane of anaesthesia if you feel you need to. And you're basically setting up a system where the fish is going to sit nicely padded. You've got something putting anaesthetic laden water over the gills. You've got an aquarium pump sucking up the water from the bottom of your container, bringing it back round over the gills again to act as your anaesthetic delivery system. You fill the system up. And then you basically need to make sure it's set up ready to go for your fish to come onto. So in here, we've got the fish sitting on the top here with the material flowing down into the reservoir in the water below. Your fish can then be moved into position. And then we need to make sure that we're getting the water flowing over the gill arches bilaterally in here. So we tend to use a Y connector to ensure we get that over the sides of the fish. Of course, in a lot of cases, particularly with a koi, you may be asked to come and visit them on the site. And this then presents you with a different challenge where you have an enthusiastic owner and their fish, and you're thinking, what am I going to do to actually start looking at you? Now, if they've been smart, they will have already acquired the fish that are concerning them and isolated them, maybe in somewhere where you can actually have a decent look at them, you can manipulate them, you can handle them, you can get them out for anaesthesia, and obviously a lot of the things you would do in the clinic, you can do on site. And obviously this is something you would do for group problems. They're not going to get stressed to transportment. You can treat, diagnose them on the site and deal with that. So think about all the things you're going to want, take them all with you. So in this particular circumstance, we've got scales, so we can individually weigh fish for parenteral treatment. We've got a bunch of towels and things here, needles, syringes, medications. We've got a little tub we've planned for anaesthesia with the fish here that's already lost its writing reflex. We've got some bicarb here and bits and pieces. So we've got everything we think we're going to need to do this on site. It's, you know, as you would do for anything else. And obviously then you can anaesthetize your fish on site, evaluate it, treat it, get it back in the water. If you do have areas of superficial damage to these guys and you're concerned either it's a surgical site from a mass you've removed that's gone for biopsy or something, then Aurabase is a great product. You can use this to pack any deficits to reduce the osmotic stress in that patient. And fish are quite exciting in the way that they heal, in that what happens is once you physically remove debris, the epithelial cells will migrate across that surface and produce a single layer to obviously as a barrier for osmosis and then subsequently divide back to heal the ulcer. Roxor again is a commonly used treatment. 1 teaspoon per litre can also help settle down osmotic stress for them as well, and is obviously something that we do recommend with a lot of these cases. If you're thinking you do have bacterial disease or there's infection to be creeping in, again, we're down to gram-negative aerobes with sort of resistance. Amikacin and enrofloxacin are commonly used. Amoxicillin, less so maybe, but amoxicillin will last for up to 7 or 14 days. So if I was treating routine ulcers, then I would probably inject with some amoxiclav, thinking I need to do that once and that's done. And in terms of giving fish injections, we don't want to damage the cuticle of the fish, so lots of scrubbing with iodine is not needed. You're just injecting between the scales, and in most cases between the muscle bellies, to try and pick up on the circulation between them to get better pickup of your drug, because they're white muscled, if that makes sense. You can gavage fish. Crop needles that we would use for the birds and reptiles. You can get your dose, you can grab your fish, you give its mouth just a little bit of squeeze on the side, and obviously you can then place it straight into the stomach and get the food in where you want to, or the drugs in where you want to. Of course, there's no risk of accidental intubation in these because they don't have a trachea. But obviously if you've got a group, you may be thinking, how am I going to do this? And you might be reaching for in water treatment, and there's loads of commercially available in water treatments out there for you to do that. Or you may be going to be looking at giving medication in food, thinking, okay, I know they eat 1% of their body weight per day when they're metabolically active. I just then need to give, if you like, 100 times overdose in my food. If I want 10 mgs per kg, I'm going to give a gram per kilo of food to get 10 mgs per kg into the fish. And here you're looking at gelatin or corn oil or something. You mix this with your agent that you wish to do the dosing, based, like I say, 100 times the dose you want in mgs per kg. Mix it in with your fish food, and then you just dry it, and you're done really here. So this is just a ratio. That's all it is. We don't need to know how much the fish weigh or anything. It's a ratio in food. So mix your gelatin up, let the gelatin cool, add your product to that. Spread it evenly over your fish food, and like I said, then you've got an easy route for getting treatment into them. For the in-water treatment, we're concerned about the filter viability. So don't basically treat them in their pond or their tank if you can help it. Treat them in a dip or a bath separate Fish can come out, fish can be rinsed, fish can be put back into its normal tank as well. And it also means if there's less of a risk of toxicity or protracted irritation to the fish. There's loads of commercially available products at the aquarium centres. They're all on the small animal exemption scheme. They all work perfectly fine. It's very rare for you to use a veterinary licensed product in this sort of manner. Final point for the fish really here is just to have a little bit of a think about analgesia. We do use non-steroidals, we do use opioids, we do use local blockades in these as well. We've got to be humane to our patients. And here's just some doses that you might want to use if you're thinking of engaging in doing surgery for these. We've got severe ulcer disease, things like that. We do have one question come through from the audience here where we're basically looking at, let's suggest you were thinking you were going to try and start seeing fish. What things would you need to get you started? What sort of things will we be recommending? And I think I probably would come up with a lot of things you got in the clinic you can modify and use for sure. But I think there's a few things that I would want to have to hand. Again, not too expensive, thankfully. I'd certainly want a water quality test kit. I need to be able to check my water quality for my anaesthetized fish and for the fish coming in. I then need to be in a position to provide suitable water for them to do things in the clinic. That means I'm going to need a dechlorinator or dechlorinator, some sodium thiosulfate, and I'm probably going to want a pump or an air stone so I can oxygenate that water more effectively as well. I'm then going to think about, I'm going to need to anaesthetize the odd fish. How am I going to achieve that? And I get some Aquased for those purposes. Then I'm going to be thinking about what if I need to give in food medication. Then I'm going to want some gelatin or corn oil ready for that. And then I'm going to think about if I have lots of ulcers, which we do see quite commonly, or I remove an eye or I remove a mass. They don't have any subcutaneous tissue. You cannot suture these closed. You're going to be left with a deficit. We know that's going to cause osmotic stress. So I'm probably going to go for some Aurabase or something that will stick and fill that deficit. And then maybe I might also have a little tub of rock salt sitting around in the event my clients don't know the difference between rock salt and normal salt to make sure they are just using straight sodium chloride in that. So I might have some rock salt knocking around. And with what is a very simple, economical box of bits and pieces, I'm in a position now that I can anaesthetize fish for simple things. I can remove masses. I can treat ulcers. I could go on site and test water quality. I can take my gill snips and skin samples looking for parasites. I've got all the sort of things that I need to start working my way through, starting to embrace fish as clients. And it does depend. A lot of your pet owners are very rewarding, very thankful that you've actually expressed an interest in treating their animal. Some of the site visits depends on the owner, how enthusiastic they are and how much they perceive vets as being a benefit. But certainly when you're looking at people who are starting in the hobby or having pet fish at home, they tend to be very grateful that you actually have bothered to express an interest in their pet fish, to which they bonded quite markedly. I'm now going to pass you back to Eimear. That's the end of the webinar.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Kevin for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.